This spring, if you'd rather spend time enjoying your lawn instead of trying to keep it alive, there's good news. TruGreen is the easiest and most affordable way to get a beautiful lawn. All you have to do is water and mow, and they'll do the rest. Weed control, fertilization, aeration, and even some things you might not even think of. They'll do all of it, while you can do literally anything else. With True Green, you could have your lawn looking as good as a putting green. That's not hyperbole. True Green is the official lawn care treatment provider of the PGA Tour. True Green offers a satisfaction guarantee, and they have a verified best price promise, which guarantees you the lowest price with no compromise on quality. You do you. Let True Green do your lawn care. Visit TrueGreen.com to get the best lawn at the best price with the best people guaranteed.
Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
This is Intelligence Matters with former acting director of the CIA, Michael Morell. Brought to you by Lockheed Martin. Your mission is ours.
Adam Schiff is a member of Congress representing California's 28th Congressional District. He is serving in his 10th term, and he is the chairman of the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence. I just interviewed Adam for a student event at the Michael V. Hayden Center at the Schar School of Policy and Government at George Mason University. We're going to bring you that conversation after a word from our sponsor. I'm Michael Morell, and this is Intelligence Matters.
The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Congressman, it's great to see you again. And it's great that you could join us for this joint Hayden Center and CBS News Intelligence Matters podcast episode. It's sort of two birds with one stone. I really want to spend most of the evening, as I'm sure you do, looking forward rather than looking back. But I do want to ask a couple of questions about the last 4 years. We were chatting earlier and you used the word difficult. They were difficult 4 years for both the intelligence community and for the House Intelligence Committee. But I'm wondering, with regard to the intelligence community, if difficult equated to damage, right? Was there real damage done to the IC? If so, what was that? How much? And how do we fix it?
Thank you, Michael, for inviting me, and thanks for the question. Was there damage? I think the answer is yes. It was multifaceted damage. Probably the most serious damage was to the reputation of the community for essentially nonpartisan analysis. The workforce continued doing their job in a professional way. But at some of the very highest levels of the IC, including in the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, you had appointed officials who were, I think, unquestionably politicizing the intelligence. And I think that they cultivated an environment at some of the agencies where the workforce had real concerns about whether an objective analysis would be welcome at the highest levels or whether it would be career ending. Often when intelligence was shared publicly, it was done so in a way to suit the narrative that the former president wished to tell, rather than a straight recitation of the facts. And so I think that was deeply damaging to the reputation of the intelligence community, to the functioning of the community. I think it also injured some of our relationships with our overseas partners who had profound concerns whether information they shared would be protected, whether information they shared would be politicized. There was at one point early in the last administration where some of our overseas partners were accused of spying on the then president of the United States. That does damage to our relationships. Now, as you know, Michael, those relationships are really strong. They have survived those trials. But we have work to do, I think, to rebuild within the community the understanding that the agencies need to speak truth to power, whether that's power in the executive or power in the Congress. You know, as I would often communicate to my intelligence colleagues, I want you to tell me exactly what your best analysis is, whether you think I want to hear it or I don't. I'm counting on you to do that. And I know with the appointments that the Biden administration has made, that that kind of independence will be restored. And I think it will help improve morale within the workforce. There's also been damage, I think, to the relationship between the intelligence committees on the Hill and the community. And I look forward to working to restore that. I'm in particular want to resurrect something I was doing prior to the last 4 years, which is doing some town halls within the IC. I, you know, enjoyed going over to the agency, for example, and doing a town hall with the workforce where, you know, they got to ask me questions about what it's like testifying in Congress and what the members are thinking. And I remember one of the analysts asking me what keeps me up at night. And I thought, well, the fact you're asking me is going to keep me up at night. But I do think the damage that's been done can all be repaired. And I think given the caliber of people the Biden administration is bringing in at the very top, it can be repaired in short order.
There's one piece of damage that I'm worried about long term, which is because of the actions and words of Donald Trump for 4 years, there are many Americans who supported him who now see the IC as part of this, quote, deep state, right? Who see the IC not as a defender of America, but as an organization trying to undermine it, right? So how do we deal with that perception that's out there among some of our fellow citizens?
You know, that's a really good point and a good question. That's gonna be harder to overcome. And of course, it's not a problem confined to the IC. That kind of falsehood or myth has been propagated about the law enforcement community, about the State Department. And, you know, it used to take the form of, you know, complaints that any administration might have about the bureaucracy. But this deep state myth is deeply damaging. And I'm sure you recognize it. Michael, it's what we used to hear in other countries, often in third world countries that were really prone to conspiracy theories. You know, I once went to Pakistan and there was this conspiracy theory that I was John Negroponte and I was there on a mission to try to change the judgments of the Pakistan Supreme Court in dealing with Musharraf. And I thought, you know, my God, I'm glad we don't have those kind of crazy conspiracies at home. Well, now we do. Yeah. And I'm not sure there's a shortcut to that problem as long as I think Donald Trump is on the political scene, and given the fealty that Kevin McCarthy has now pledged to him, and Mitch McConnell after that stirring speech he gave on the Senate floor about Trump's responsibility for the insurrection, pledged his support for Donald Trump should Donald Trump become the nominee. So I don't see a quick end to that problem particularly.
Congressman, you mentioned the new leadership in the IC. So we have Avril Haines as the DNI. We have David Cohen back as Deputy Director of CIA. Bill Burns yesterday had his confirmation hearing, and it appears an almost certainty that he will be confirmed by the Senate. Love to know your thoughts about these folks. Love to know about any interactions you've had so far and what you might have advised them.
You know, I think they're all superb choices. I would love to see a Mike Morrell having joined their company or join their company in the future. But as you know, these are really quality people. And I've had a chance to speak with all of them. I think they will put as priority number one, restoring that independence to the intelligence community. But I also like the decades of experience that Bill Burns brings in diplomacy. That's an interesting background to bring to the CIA. There are times, I think, where there's a tendency to think, particularly if you've grown up within the IC, that the IC is the answer to every problem. And, you know, frankly, there are also a lot of people in the IC who recognize all too well, it is not the answer to every problem, and have to tell presidents of the United States, you can't rely on the IC to do everything. Right. But I think that he will bring a very broad perspective of, here's the State Department's role, here's the Defense Department's role, here's USAID's role, here's the intelligence community role, and here's how we need to make sure all of these parts of the government are working together in pursuit of U.S. policy interests. I'm, you know, very excited about the experience he brings. And I think Dave and Avril have, you know, such a background within the agency, but also with respect to terrorism finance, on cyber issues, a lot of, you know, the real challenging issues of the day. So I have a lot of confidence in this group, and can't wait for them all to be seated. And I'm sure, judging from how well, you know, the love fest with Bill Burns, that will happen soon.
Any idea when we might see a worldwide threat hearing?
You know, that's one thing I brought up with each of these designees and appointees, the desire to go back to doing those, to do those on a quarterly basis. They all committed to doing that. So I would imagine fairly soon. And that was a good indication, frankly, the cancellation of those open worldwide threats hearings was a pretty solid indication that the then leadership of the IC, whether it was Grinnell or Ratcliffe or others, were not willing to speak truth to power. You know, to his credit, Dan Coats, when he was ODNI, spoke forthrightly, publicly. And what he said publicly was consistent with what he said privately. Now it ended up forcing him out of his position. But, you know, that's the responsibility you take on in leadership of these agencies. And if a president doesn't want that, then I think, frankly, you're better off leaving the administration. I hope to have those worldwide threat hearings, open hearings, back on schedule shortly.
So for the committee, Congressman, you've said repeatedly that you want to get partisanship out of the committee. You want to get back to comity. I'm just wondering how you think you're doing in making progress on that. Do you think it's possible in this era to get politics out of there? How do you see the committee going forward?
Well, I certainly hope so. And I've already discussed this with a couple of my Republican colleagues on the committee, including the ranking member Nunes. I would like to get back to some level of comity. I realize it's going to take time. You know, frankly, within the Democratic caucus, there is continuing anger, among other emotions, over the fact that even after the failed insurrection, so many of our Republican colleagues were back on the House floor trying to overturn the results of the election and propagating the same falsehoods that led to that attack on the Capitol. Most of the Republicans on the Intelligence Committee are among that group. But nonetheless, the work of the committee has to get done. And so I've been talking to Republican members about trying to reset. You know, I will say that, and this is a kind of an untold story of the House Intel Committee, even over the last 4 years where it was so acrimonious on our committee, we nonetheless got the Intelligence Authorization Act done every year. And so we were able to compartmentalize. But what I have urged in the past, and I will urge again, is even in those areas where we disagree, whether it was the Russia investigation, the Ukraine investigation, the investigation we're undertaking now into politicization of intelligence at the Department of Homeland Security, let's at least keep those differences within civil limits. And that's my hope. I'm going to do my part My colleagues on the other side of the aisle will have to decide whether they're interested in that. I can't do it for both sides, so I hope they will take me up on it.
And I'm wondering if China, you know, given the importance of China, given that everybody agrees this is the challenge of the moment, that that could be something that people can rally around and agree on and work together on.
Without a doubt. And, you know, indeed, in the last 2 years of Devin Nunes' chairmanship, they did a focus on China. In the first 2 years of my chairmanship, I did a focus on China. And we produced a, I think, very well-received report on China and how the Intelligence Committee really needed to reposition itself to deal with the challenge of China. We obviously, and for understandable reasons, have devoted so much within the IC to dealing with the counterterrorism threat. And at the same time, have really not sufficiently addressed the rise of China and the extraordinary challenge and threat China poses in practically every field of domain, on the seas, on land, in space, in the cyber realm. And you know, a particular interest and concern of mine, indeed, the very first hearing I had 2 years ago as chairman of the Intel Committee was on authoritarianism and how China was exporting its digital totalitarian model with its ubiquitous CCTV camera, its Orwellian named Safe Cities Initiative, its use of big data analytics. And this was every bit as much of a threat to democracy globally as anything the Russians were doing.
Mm-hmm. So I want to ask you about some priorities. And I want to start with China. So it's a great transition. And I want to start with the report that your committee put out, which I thought was terrific and which was bipartisan. It was quite critical of the IC. It said, let me quote here, the IC requires a significant and immediate reprioritization and realignment of resources to meet the threat from Beijing. The report did not come out directly and say that our collection wasn't what it should be, but you could kind of read that between the lines. The report had over 100 recommendations. I'm wondering, how did the IC react to that? Have they made any progress? And what do you consider to be the most important of those recommendations?
You know, I think the IC reacted very responsibly and respectfully. And I think it is receptive to the recommendations that we made. I thought it was interesting in the executive summary that the most redacted part of the summary was part of our recommendations, which I took it to mean they thought those were areas where they needed improvement. It wasn't meant to be a criticism as much as it was meant to be constructive and to, you know, just recognize the reality of the changing world circumstances. The counterterrorism threat, the terrorism threat has not gone away. We're just going to have to be more efficient in how we address it because the threat from China is so elevated and they are a very worthy rival in so many ways. I think that in terms of prioritizing the recommendations, it's difficult to be specific since some of them I can't go into, but we need to make sure, and this is kind of a cross-cutting challenge the IC has always had, that we have the personnel that understand the China problem set, that have the linguistic skills. It is not sufficient to simply have China expertise in a mission focused on China. It needs to really be diffused throughout the IC so that when you're looking at particular problem sets, there are people within those parts of the agencies with expertise about China. I think one of the other big challenges we have, and this is, not a criticism, but a reflection of Chinese technological sophistication, that the operating environment within China has become so difficult. Right. Not just in China, it's become more difficult everywhere. You add to that the extraordinary and tragic success of Chinese espionage in terms of stealing data from U.S. agencies and private sector entities, the Chinese ability to assimilate that data, to try to identify who works in the IC and who doesn't work in the IC, the problem of digital dust in an increasingly digital world, and it just goes to underscore the breadth and depth of the challenges. So that requires a kind of a whole of government, but a whole of IC effort to meet that challenge, and we are up to it. But it will require changing the direction of that big aircraft carrier that we call the IC.
We're going to take a quick break to hear from our sponsor, and we'll be right back with more of our discussion with Congressman Schiff.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
Would you say that China is the biggest national security challenge that you've seen in your lifetime?
Well, you know, I'm old enough, as you are, to remember the Soviet Union. So I don't know that I would say in my lifetime. But I would say that the danger from Russia, which is a declining power, you know, is the danger that you face from a wounded animal that is dangerous because it's wounded and desperate. And Russia very much sees the world in a zero-sum game with the United States. But China is on the rise, and China is already formidable. You know, it used to be not that long ago that the way Americans viewed China was, they're good at copying our technology. They're good at copying our innovation. They're good at stealing our intellectual property. They're not so good at developing their own. We pointed to our education system as a part of the reason why that China was producing individuals that were more inclined to groupthink than innovation. That was probably an inaccurate stereotype in the past. It's certainly not an apt description in the present. China is a real innovator in every field of domain. And so it's also clear that while China historically was focused in an inward direction, they are increasingly focused in an outward direction. They're increasingly self-confident and increasingly willing to challenge the United States and regional powers in the South China Sea and elsewhere. So I think that over time, China will only continue to eclipse the threat we face from other places. You know, that's not to obviously diminish the threat posed by Iran and North Korea, but there's no other country that poses such an across-the-board challenge as China.
Congressman, the second issue I wanted to ask you about is your committee's doing a deep dive on the coronavirus pandemic and the IC's response to that, reporting on it, et cetera. And so I want to kind of take that and ask kind of a broad question here about sort of non-traditional intelligence topics. So, you know, global health, climate change. How do you think about the IC's role in those kinds of issues? How do you think about the IC's responsibilities versus the responsibilities of other government agencies? How do you think about that?
Yeah, those are exactly the right questions. And, you know, we've been having an internal debate about this, you know, a debate at times between the parties on the committee, a debate sometimes within our party as well. You know, for years, as you know, we have tried to prioritize these, you know, what were called soft threats. And it's been a struggle when it came to climate change, for example. We have created, you know, a center to focus on that issue, but it's one of the areas where every year in the Intelligence Authorization Act, we have a fight over climate. The reality is, and it should be just obvious, climate's having effect, for example, in sea lanes in the Arctic, opening up new possibilities for the Chinese Navy, for the Russian Navy. Resource scarcity in Yemen creates additional national security threats for the United States. The fact that, you know, some of our naval bases are underwater and not in a good way is a national security issue and an intel issue. So there's no question that climate is having an impact on our security, and that keeping an eye to those impacts and where they will aggravate dangers to the country is an important IC responsibility. But if anything brought home or should have brought home the need to pay attention to some of these non-traditional threats is the pandemic. And with the pandemic, you know, we continue to have an internal debate as part of the deep dive we're doing on what's the IC's role, what's the IC's lane, how do we make sure there's the kind of collaboration between the intelligence community and the public health community and other parts of the US government and international organizations to deal with pandemic threats. I think one thing is certain, the IC has an important role to play. And you know, that role, for example, can be in early detection of potential pandemics when host governments may not be interested in transparency. In fact, may be affirmatively trying to hide the magnitude of a problem. And, you know, just to, you know, allude to public reporting, you know, there's public reporting about, you know, how crowded hospitals in Wuhan were, what the parking lots look like. Well, you can see parking lots from space. And, you know, if you have good enough AI and you have good enough analysts and good enough tipping and queuing, you can look for the signs of potential health crises and pandemics, and as well to learn of how governments are responding and how a problem may be migrating. So there is definitely an intelligence community lane here, but at the same time, we have to be careful that agencies that we need to work with on the global stage aren't going to view with suspicion our health agencies with the false impression that they are now intelligence agencies. You know, again, referring to public reporting, for example, about the search for bin Laden, there's public reporting without commenting on whether it's accurate or not, because frankly, it doesn't matter whether it's accurate or not at one level, that a vaccination program may have played a role. You know, if there is a intermingling between health issues and intelligence community issues, it can end up degrading an important healthcare effort. So we are in this deep dive trying to figure out how is the IC resourced to focus on this problem set. We have 500,000 Americans dead. Had that been the result of a terrorist attack, you can imagine the analysis that we'd be undergoing to figure out why wasn't the IC better able to thwart this? And you know, and I think it's appropriate to do the same analysis while recognizing the IC is only one part of the tripwire. You know, this gets to another issue, Michael, that you've been deeply involved in, and that is we need to make good use of open source information, because some of the best early information on the pandemic was open source information. So, what we hope to do is, you know, look at, for example, the National Medical Unit within DOD that has a seminal role in pandemic ascertainment is very small, and it's in DOD. Now, that may have made sense when health threats like a pandemic were viewed through a defense prism. Does it still make sense? And so those are the issues that we're looking at and the questions we're trying to answer.
I know that you know that I agree 100% with you on open source. Somehow we have to get people in the IC to believe that just because something's not stamped top secret, right, or secret, that it's somehow not as important, right? I think that's a cultural issue we have to get over.
You're absolutely right. And it's kind of the flip side, in a way, of the problem we were talking about earlier in what a difficult operating environment China is now, because of all the private data that they have stolen and their sophistication in terms of technology. There's also now tremendous amounts of open source information. If we know how to look for it, if we know how to find the needles in the huge haystack, and one of the things that we're trying to determine there is how is open source treated within the intelligence community? Is there a center of excellence, or do we have a lot of jack of all trades and master of none? So those are some questions we're trying to answer also.
The third issue, Congressman, I wanted to raise was SolarWinds. As you know, devastating hack. Nobody's talked about it this way, but I'm wondering to what extent, you know, did the IC miss this? You know, at some point, the Russians were obviously, if it was the Russians were planning this. At some point, they began preparations. They carried out those preparations. They carried out the attack. You know, shouldn't CIA, NSA, others have seen that? How do you think about that question?
Yeah. Well, I think that the, I guess I would say a couple of things. First of all, there's only so much that we can do with our cyber capability to ascertain what our foreign adversaries are doing. So if we're always going to count on the IC to see what our adversaries are doing and stop it before they succeed, we're going to have a lot of failures and costly failures. We are going to have to up our game in terms of looking at what the Russians and other bad actors are doing and how they're doing it to try to guard against things like SolarWinds. But that's only one piece of the puzzle. We're going to have to be much better at defense. And here, I think the IC was aware there was a real vulnerability when it came to the supply chain. But not enough was done, I think, within the IC and outside the IC. Not enough has been done in the private sector to shore up and secure the supply chain. And in particular, as we see with SolarWinds, when a supply chain vendor who supplies a product that's important to a lot of operating systems sends something that they've authenticated but encrypted, it's a really difficult problem set. And so we've been aware of the problem. It's not like it's a surprise, but we haven't obviously done what needed to be done to guard against it. And we're going to have to, and we're going to have to figure out, what does this mean in terms of how actively involved the IC needs to be in the work of the vendors? What kind of disclosure requirements do we need to make of the private sector when they're have been infiltrations and problems. You probably saw the comments of Microsoft's COO, the testimony recently that, they're being transparent, but the intimation was there are other companies that have decided not to because it's not good for business to admit that you've been successfully hacked in any way. And so Senator Warner, I think, has proposed something like the kind of entity and review after a plane crash to determine what went wrong. And I like that concept very much so that there is a independent analysis and corrective action taken. We're also going to have to, decide what part of the supply chain do we need to bring in-house? And of course, look at the whole other aspect of supply chain problems in supplies that we obtain from overseas. So big problem, yes, big failure in terms of the intelligence community, the private sector. You know, the fact, frankly, we had to learn about this from the private sector is also, I think, deeply embarrassing to the intelligence community. So we have a lot of work to do.
And then the last specific issue I wanted to ask you about is domestic terrorism. So you have been the victim of domestic terrorism. And I'm wondering how you think about the IC's role in domestic terrorism, if any, given Fourth Amendment concerns.
You know, and actually, given you raised the Fourth Amendment issue, let me make one other observation about solar winds. And here, again, referring to public reporting. But if public reporting is accurate that the Russians took advantage of utilizing U.S. facilities to mount part of its cyber attack, knowing that the authorities we can use domestically are much more limited than the authorities we can use internationally, then we have to figure out that problem, too. In terms of the domestic terrorism threat and the IC role, you know, clearly there's an intelligence community role when there is a foreign component, foreign support of domestic bad actors. There is also an intelligence community role through the Department of Homeland Security at the FBI in terms of sharing the information that it obtains with law enforcement authorities and make sure that it's done in a timely way, that that the intelligence is shared in a form where it will be paid attention to. You know, on the basis of the public testimony thus far, we can see there are real issues and discrepancies about what was the quality state of the intelligence, how much of it was shared. If it was shared, was it shared in a format where it, you know, it was sounding the alarm, or was it shared in the format of, well, we can find a document we sent to you, so you should have paid attention to it. We are doing an investigation in our committee, working in concert with other committees, to determine how much of this was a failure to gather the right intelligence, how much was it a failure to share that intelligence, and how much of it was a failure to act on that intelligence. You know, I won't be surprised if there's responsibility to be attributed at every stage of the process, but the intelligence community does, consistent with our, you know, domestic authorities and constitutional requirements, have a role. It is not the paramount role, but it is an important one.
Maybe the last issue we can talk about before we go to questions is this whole idea of the IC and technology. And one of the ways I think about it is there's kind of three things we have to get right. One is we have to collect on and understand where our adversaries are with regard to technological advancements, right? Two is we have to use technology to do a better job ourselves in the IC. And then three, we have to protect ourselves, right, against the technology that our adversaries are using against us and the operations that we're conducting. And I think you would agree that we need to be on the cutting edge, right, and stay there. And I know you agree with that. How far do we have to go to get there? Are we moving? Are we moving fast enough? Do we have to think about new approaches? Do we have to think about new approaches to the government working with the private sector? How do you think about that big, big problem?
Yeah. Well, you know, I think we are on the cutting edge. I don't think we're playing catch up in that respect. Now, there are other countries like China that are ahead in certain areas. But frankly, I think we still maintain the technological advantage. But the delta is narrowing. So I think China is making rapid gains. And if we don't make a renewed investment in research and development, and here I'm speaking not just of the IC, but as a nation, then we will be eclipsed. And that will have, I think, catastrophic repercussions for us and for the free world. Because we really are in a new battle of ideas, not communism versus capitalism, as much as it is authoritarianism versus democracy. We can't keep kicking immigrants out of our country who get advanced degrees from Caltech in STEM fields. That's you know, economic and national security suicide. We can't keep underinvesting in science and technology and research and development, either in the public or private sector. In the private sector, you know, this chase for quarterly profits, in which companies aren't incentivized to invest in the long term in their research and development, and we've seen a real and precipitous decline in the investment, corporate investment in R&D, is catastrophic. One of the profound issues I think that we need to grapple with, and it's exemplified by Huawei and ZTE, is how does the United States compete with China when China is willing to put billions in a state-run enterprise, is willing to essentially be a loss leader, underprice the global market, drive competition out of the market, and then enjoy a monopoly on a technology that is a critical technology, like 5G. It's very hard, we have found, in pushing back against Huawei, to compete with something with nothing. When we've had these conversations, as I've had with our European partners and others, about the security risks that are present in a technology like Huawei's 5G, their response is, what's your alternative? And I do think that it's going to force us to, really grapple with a big question that we haven't had to, probably since we felt challenged by the Japanese model in the 90s. And that is, do we need to explore a different kind of public-private partnership to compete in certain critical technologies to make sure that we always have an American alternative? And so those conversations are happening. I think they're still at a very nascent stage, and they need to happen much quicker.
That was Congressman Adam Schiff. I'm Micah Morrell. Please join us next week for another episode of Intelligence Matters.
Intelligence Matters is sponsored by Lockheed Martin. Your mission is ours. This show is produced by Olivia Gassis, Jamie Benson, Jake Rosen, Paulina Smolinski, and Ariana Freeman. For more from this week's show, visit cbsnews.com. Intelligence Matters is a production of CBS Audio.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.